I wanted to study fashion. There's not very many Americans that want to study fashion from an arts and humanities perspective, and I really wanted to do that. And I owe that to Gwen O'Neill, who said, stick with what you like. And then Trish did the same thing. These two women just really believed in me, and they said, stick with it. It will make you a success. Don't go to trend research. Don't do what everyone else is doing. Just stick with what you want to do and find the niche where you need to find the niche. So that's my story. That's how I've done what I've done. But the one thing I will say to you in my heart of hearts, this is where the journal comes in. I wasn't the only one doing this. I wasn't by myself. And I saw so many people when I was involved with the Pop Culture Association, I saw so many people that didn't have a place to put their scholarship. They would do these wonderful papers.
Welcome to another episode of Innovation Insights, where we dive into the mind shaping the future of industries through innovation, creativity, and groundbreaking research. We believe that innovation happens in all aspects of life. Today, we have the privilege of hosting a distinguished guest whose expertise spans academia, retail, and the intricate narratives of fashion branding. Dr. Joseph Joe Henry Hancock II. Joe Henry Hancock II is a luminary in the field known internationally for his pioneering scholarship and profound insights into fashion branding as a form of storytelling. Dr. Hancock's journey is as fascinating as it is inspiring. With a rich background of over 20 years in the retail industry, he has held leadership roles at legendary companies such as The Gap, L Brands, and Target Corporation, where he honed his merchandising and brand development expertise. Transitioning into academia, Joe brought his wealth of industry knowledge to Drexel University, where he has been molding the minds of future leaders in fashion and branding. An international authority on cargo pants, Dr. Hancock's research explores the symbolism and cultural significance of transnational mass fashion garments, diving deep into the narratives that clothing can convey. His work is characterized by a passionate commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion, themes that have been central to his research since his master's thesis in 1997. Through his academic and consulting work, Joe consistently advocates for marginalized communities and social outcasts, demonstrating the power of fashion as a tool for social change. Dr. Hancock is the author and editor of several influential books, including Brand Story, Ralph, Vera, Johnny, Billy, and Other Adventures in Fashion Branding, and the book Fashion in Popular Culture. He also serves as the principal editor of the peer-reviewed journal Fashion, Style, and Popular Culture, which gives us a discourse on fashion and popular culture. Joe's work sheds light on the intricacies of fashion branding and emphasizes the importance of storytelling and meaningful connections between brands and their audiences. Listeners, please join me in welcoming Dr. Joe Hancock to the Innovation Insights podcast as we prepare to dive into a conversation that promises to be enlightening as it is engaging. Dr. Hancock, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Okay, first I'm going to say this. I cannot believe I'm being interviewed by the famous Yolanda Saunders. You are an inspiration to everyone, and I was very honored that you even chose me to do this. And I couldn't, when you were reading my bio, I'm like, who is she talking about? So I could not believe you were talking about me. So I just want to thank you so much for letting me be a part of this today, because it means a lot to me.
Well, thank you. And, you know, you are just amazing. And we've known each other now for probably 20 years, I think.
Oh my, 30. Well, we're both 40 now. Now, by the way, that bio, I'm still 40 now. We've probably known each other since the 90s, since 1997. My first conference presentation, And I think you were there, was 1996. And yes. It was under the supervision of Dr. Gwendolyn O'Neill. And yeah. It started my whole passion of wanting to study semiotics, hermeneutics. And it was Strike a Pose, the deconstruction of a postmodern ad. And it was a Jean-Paul Gaultier commercial that I did on perfume. And I literally had to go to a learning lab and freeze the commercial in frames because we did not have technology like we do now. And turn those freeze frames into slides for a slide projector. So, I mean, you and I remember the day when you had to buy the slide carousel. Like that was absolutely. The standard that you had to carry around. Yeah. So
absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely.
And I've always had a passion for historic costume, although I'm not considered a historic costume person. And that's always been your passion. So I like to look at fashion in general, but I usually look at contemporary fashion. But I always say that yesterday is history. So, you know, you go to the mall, you buy something, you bought it yesterday. Guess what? You bought historical costume. You bought historical fashion because it was yesterday. So, yeah, that's kind of how we have our bonds. We both like the fashion world.
Absolutely. Love the fashion world. And it's just been fun to be connected with you, work with you over the years. And, you know, just support all of your initiatives. I mean, you have been a true innovator within our discipline by starting a journal, which is not an easy endeavor to do, and then to elevate that journal within the discipline too. So,
yeah, I've appreciated you because you were one of the first people to jump on board. You've been on the journal for 10 years. And it was a really hard endeavor as far as pitching it to Intellect. I pitched it to Masoud Yazani, who owned Intellect at the time. And I have to tell you, I owe the word style to the famous scholar and street style person, Ted Polemus, who said to me, Joe, you put the word style in there and it's going to take off. I was just going to do fashion and popular culture. And it was Ted that said, no, put style in there because style is more important than fashion. More people are style people than fashion people. So I did that and it's just taken off ever since. But what I did is I tried to identify those folks that really weren't part of anything. Nobody had really said, hey, would you be willing to do this? Would you be willing to be part of a journal? A lot of people have been forgotten in our fashion disciplines and they're on the fringes, but they've made significant contributions here and there. And I searched those people out. And then I also searched out those people that I basically say we're somewhat marginalized because,
absolutely.
Yeah. And I've always had a passion for historic costume, although I'm not considered a historic costume person. And that's always been your passion. So I like to look at fashion in general, but I usually look at contemporary fashion. But I always say that yesterday is history. So, you know, you go to the mall, you buy something, you bought it yesterday. Guess what? You bought historical costume. You bought historical fashion because it was yesterday. So yeah, that's kind of how we have our bonds. We both like the fashion world.
Absolutely. Love the fashion world. And it's just been fun to be connected with you, work with you over the years, and you know, just support all of your initiatives. I mean, you have been a true innovator within our discipline by starting a journal, which is not an easy endeavor to do, and then to elevate that journal within the discipline too. So
I've appreciated you because you were one of the first people to jump on board. You've been on the journal for 10 years. And it was a really hard endeavor as far as pitching it to Intellect. I pitched it to Masoud Yazani, who owned Intellect at the time. And I have to tell you, I owe the word style to the famous scholar and street style person, Ted Polemus, who said to me, Joe, you put the word style in there and it's going to take off. I was just going to do fashion and popular culture. And it was Ted that said, no, put style in there because style is more important than fashion. More people are style people than fashion people. So I did that and it's just taken off ever since. But what I did is I tried to identify those folks that really weren't part of anything. Nobody had really said, hey, would you be willing to do this? Would you be willing to be part of a journal? A lot of people have been forgotten in our fashion disciplines, and they're on the fringes, but they've made significant contributions here and there. And I searched those people out. And then I also searched out those people that I basically say were somewhat marginalized, because maybe they were the first to do, they worked first and then they got into academia. And for a while, we were only celebrating the traditional scholar. And I thought, you know what, people that have been in industry that have become scholars have a lot to contribute. So that was really important to me. That was something that I thought, okay, I've got to do this. So I put together this ragtag group of people, and you were one of them. And it's just taken off ever since. What I'm doing now is, what I'm struggling with now is, as I age, I'm trying to identify those young folks that can come in and that are doing innovative things that can be a new part of the journal. So that's what happens. And one thing about us as a journal, people don't know this. We're a working board. So that means we work. I haven't lately, Yolanda, you haven't heard from me in a while, but I haven't sent out anything. We have gone completely electronic now. We're testing that out. And then the other thing I'm doing is I do every year to say, hey, do you still want to be a part of this? Do you want to still be on this? And so I haven't done that lately, but we continue to grow and we continue to get bigger. We've gone from 3 issues a year to 4. I don't think there's going to be a 5. Doing a 5, it's not an issue of me doing the work. It's an issue of the cost. Mm-hmm. It's very expensive. Mm-hmm.
That makes sense. Yeah.
And thank you for thinking about that bridge between industry and academia. And that's one thing at Innovation Insights we really do support, is that bridge, because we really feel that's important. So thank you for thinking about that also with your journal too.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And we still do that. And to do it, we can do a short pitch for the journal. We publish practice-based as well as academic, as well as visual. So if someone's doing an exhibit, there's someone that just reviewed an exhibit that's not just a review, but it's a critique of this exhibit. That's going to be a focus of, it's a 5,000 word paper. So we look at all different types of vehicles. I tell people this all the time. They don't believe me. You go to a concert of one of the divas that's touring and you want to review it and you have some photos, please send it to us. We would love to get those reviews of concerts and events that really focus on fashion. We love that stuff.
And that's great, because there are so many venues and avenues to study fashion and style. And so thank you for being inclusive in that.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Moved into academia. So tell us about that journey.
I am a child. Okay. So I'm a child of the 80s. I'm a child of the mall. I started working in retail in 1983, and I started in high school, and I graduated high school in 85, but I worked for the Gap. And then I went to Indiana University, and I really wanted to study fashion. I really wanted to study this whole concept of how fashion works. And I got into the apparel merchandising program at Indiana University. I soon learned that I do not have the gift of the sewing machine. That is not my thing. So I actually was really more interested in the putting it all together after it's been made, and the production processes and how things are made and what they're made of. I still am I love textiles. I love the feel of things. So I think that's important. But anyway, I digress. I continued to work full time while I was in school. So I worked in a company called County Seat, which I never mention anymore because no one remembers County Seat. Direct your feet to the County Seat. I did that, and I took a break because there was no Gap in Bloomington when I first got there. And then the Gap opened in Bloomington. I went back to the Gap. I worked for them again, starting in 87, because I graduated from college in 89. I moved from Bloomington to Chicago. I lived in Chicago for a while. I had a mentor. I have to say, instructors and professors I had at Indiana University, I adore. There were quite a few. One of them was Dr. Ann Fairhurst, who is still in the world, still teaching. Another one was Dr. Kate Rowald, who I loved dearly, who is a costume historian. And they inspired me to want to become a professor. And I'll never forget Dr. Rowald. I went to see her as an undergrad, and I said to her, I want to be you when I grow up. I want to do what you do. And she said, okay. go out and work for a while. In a couple of years, if you still want to do that, we'll have you come back here. And so I went out and I worked. And so I graduated. I moved to Chicago. I worked for the Gap the entire time. Then I went back to Bloomington 3 years later, and I still worked for Gap. And then here's the surprise. The Gap paid for all of my master's program. So when people are like, why did you stay at the Gap for so long? It's because they paid for my master's degree. Mm-hmm. And I worked with Dr. Rowald. And this is the side note. I worked in the costume collection, the Sage costume collection, for about 4 years of my life, just as for fun, just because I liked it. I sewed labels and hats for 4 years of my life. I will never sew another label and a hat again. And then I actually got my master's degree, and I was really interested. At the time I was going to school, this man had written a book by the name of Roosevelt Thomas. The book was called Beyond Race and Gender, Diversity in the Workplace. And I was so inspired by that book. And I actually met a professor at IU, Dr. Lois Wise, who taught a class called Diversity in the Workplace. And it was in the School of Public Policy. I took the class. We talked about diversity. She had some articles on the importance of diversity. But what really I love is we read Tony Hillerman novels about Tony Hillerman is an author. I think I said his name right. He writes mystery novels about a detective who works in the indigenous community, like murders and stuff that happened in the indigenous communities. And then we read Ursula Le Guin's Left Side of Darkness, and we read The Joy Luck Club. And we talked about those books from the perspective of other. And so that really got me interested in this whole concept of diversity. And for the first time in my life, I felt like I belonged somewhere. Because I'm a member of the GLBTQ community, it didn't matter. It didn't matter in this classroom setting for the first time with others in the room. So I did that, and I went to Dr. Rowald, and I said, I really want to talk about public policy with merchandising and maybe do studies of how people dress at work. So that's what I ended up doing. And I worked with a very famous lady today. Going to reveal another mystery. I worked with Dr. Jana Hawley. She was my master's thesis advisor, who's now at UNT. She's the dean at UNT. So I worked with her. And then I finished my master's thesis, and I'll never forget, my mom came to school to see me graduate. And Dr. Rowald sat there and said, but you can't get your master's degree without getting your PhD. So I said, okay. So I packed myself up and I went to Columbus, Ohio, because I could not live in a small college town again. I had been in Bloomington now for about 9 years of my life. Yeah. And so I said, you know what? I need to be in a bigger place. So I went to Columbus, Ohio, through the mercy and the help of Dr. Sharon Lennon. And so I went to OSU and I worked with Dr. Gwen O'Neill until she up and left me and went to K-State. I always used to give her stuff after that. And I worked, but then I discovered the wonderful Patricia Cunningham, and I worked with her and I got my PhD. Now, during this time, I quit my job at the Gap, and a friend of mine contacted me who I had worked with at Gap, who was now in Columbus, who went to Ohio State University, and she was a marketing manager for the Limited. And she said, come out to the Limited headquarters. Come have lunch with me. Come, let's talk. And I said, okay. So I went out to lunch, and she said, do you mind if my boss comes with us? And I said, no, I don't mind. So her boss came along. And at the end of this lunch, I had a job at Limited Corporation. I didn't know it was a job interview. And I went back and I told Trish, Dr. Cunningham, I said, they offered me a job at the Limited. I said, I don't know if I should take it or not. And she said, how much does it pay? And I told her, she said, oh, you're taking the job. We'll figure this out. So I did that for 2 years. And this whole time I'm getting my PhD. And then I took a break after Limited. Limited was a 2-year gig, and I took a break. And then I was teaching a class on professional development at OSU on resume, cover letter writing, and all that fun stuff with the undergrads. And professional development is, I think, what the class was called. And I had my resume. Do you remember the lovely overhead projectors with the clear plastic pieces?
Oh, yes,
so
I do.
We're doing technology. So I had my resume on a laminate piece, and I'm showing everyone. And that day, the target recruiters had come to OSU And they were sitting in the back of the room. And Dr. Catherine Jakes had asked me if they could do that. And I said, I don't care. That's fine. And so at the end of that session, Paula Heingartner and Mark Baker, say I remember all these names, came up to me and said, would you be interested in interviewing for a job with us? We think we have a job that would suit you well. And I said, nope, not interested. And they said, oh, no, please interview. So I interviewed for the position. 13 interviews later, I was packing my bags and going to Portland, Oregon. And so I moved to Portland. I was ABD at the time, took my test, passed all that ABD. Then I moved to Portland and I was a regional field merchant for Target stores. And I had the lovely fashionable states of Southern Washington, Oregon, Idaho, Utah, and Montana. Oh, yeah. And I was a field merchant for Target while I was writing my dissertation. And so I did that. And then I got a call from Trish, Dr. Cunningham, who said, there's a job at a school called Drexel. And you told me if there was ever a job in a city, you'd apply for it. And I said, okay, fine. So I applied for the job, 2004. I got the job and here I am today. Now I digress a little bit. How did I get to cargo? I got to cargo pants because I was talking to Trish and I said, I really want to include historic costume, but I want to talk about it from a branding perspective and how brands really change the meaning of a garment. Now, mind you, this is the 2000s and Abercrombie and Fitch and Old Navy were blowing everything out of the water and they were all featuring cargo pants. And we had that ad of Carrie Donovan doing a fashion show with Magic the Dog for Old Navy. And she was talking about cargo pants. And I said, this is really changing the views of cargos. And I actually, so I did another thing at the Limited, my category that I worked with most was men's pants. So I really got interested in pants. And so I asked Trish, you know, can I do this? And she's like, I don't think so. She goes, okay, I'll tell you what, if you go and give it as an academic paper at a conference, and someone walks up to you and asks you, is this your dissertation? Or this would be a great dissertation. I'll let you do it. So I gave this paper at the Pop Culture Association. And Dr. Joe Paoletti walks up to me and goes, this has to be your dissertation topic. And I looked at Trish and she goes, okay, you can do it. And that's how I did cargo pants. That's the whole story behind the cargo pants. That's what happened. And so I did cargo pants because I just thought, no one else had done them historically. And I thought that they would be a great study. And I wanted to have fun when I was writing this thing. And I tell students all the time, have fun when you're doing your topic. So yeah, that's how I got to Targo. But that's my whole career as it goes. That's why I was working full time and going to school. I started my master's at age 25 and I finished my dissertation at 40. Mm-hmm. So 15-year journey.
Yeah. And what a great journey in that you, again, were in and out of industry as you were doing this, which I'm sure really informed how you teach.
It has. So I'm really lucky in the sense of, Drexel was a good fit for me and it wasn't a good fit for me. And I'll explain why there's two things going on here. Drexel was a great fit for me as a practice-based institution because everyone in my program has industry experience. I work with Maureen DeSimone, who was Kenneth Cole's right-hand lady all through the 80s and 90s. Like she was there with him, knows him. And so I'm always very honored by the people I work with. How it wasn't a good fit for me is it was so practice. I'm in an art college and it was so practice based and a lot of people in the college are makers. And so my mission when I got hired was to be one of the first people to write. And so when I came in, I not only had to publish, but I also had to prove to my colleagues why writing was important. Mm-hmm. So that became my mission. That was something that was really hard for me to do because there's so much value and there still is in an art college for makers. Mm-hmm. But when you're the writer and you write something, people are like, oh, great. And they think it's easy and it's actually really hard. So that I think was something I was like, you know what? I'm going to come into this place and I'm going to say, I can do this. And at the same time, I'm going to show you the value. Now, I've been at Drexel for 20 years. It's taken me 20 years to really get that I want to say admiration from folks that I am a writer. Mm-hmm. And the people that were getting admiration for writing in my college originally were the art historians. And that's basically it. Mm-hmm. For me to come into merchandising, they mm-hmm. were like, what's the value of this? And people used to call it the journal. They used to call my journal a magazine. They're like, Joe does this great magazine. And I'm like, it's not a magazine. So not only did I have to educate myself, I had to educate my colleagues on why this stuff was important and how it was important to the discipline. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I always say that my writings and what I've done are my little teeny tiny bit of contribution to Drexel being an R1 institution today. Mm-hmm. So that
your writing has been impactful. So thank you for doing that within the whole disciplines.
Yeah. And then in the classroom, I didn't even answer your question. In the classroom, because you were saying, how does it impact my teaching? In the classroom, really, I have to say something. I was given an intro class, the intro to the fashion business, like a lot of us teach, right? And then I was given retail operations and retail buying as my classes. These are your classes. We're going to give you these and you're going to teach these. It was because I had so much experience, and I want to say this to future scholars or people that want to be future scholars, life is long. Life is so long. And if I had become a professor when I was 28, I would be bored silly. I'd want to poke my eyes out. Those classes that I had in the beginning were so easy for me to teach and to put my preps together because I had so much experience in that field. And I stress this to people because it's so crucial. And the students get more today out of my life work and my life experience than they do from a theoretical ideology. And because of my experience, I'm able to say how a theory worked. Mm-hmm. And I do believe wholeheartedly in theory, mm-hmm. but I also believe that without practical application, a young person's like, well, that's nice. How does it work? Like, when does it really actually take place? Mm-hmm. And then also because of my experience, I'm able to take historical theories that we forget about the George Sproles. We forget about the Herbert. We forget about the Veblens. We forget about, but I talk about why their theory was actually happening. What was really going on? And I can look at retailing as the main force behind that. So yeah, it's important.
It is. And your students are so fortunate to have you with those industry experiences. And for undergraduate education, especially, it's so imperative that the students are hearing from individuals who actually know what's happening in the industry, too. It's really important.
It is.
Yeah.
And I have to tell you, you'll laugh at this. You and I, when we were in school, we would have professors talking about fashion in the 60s. And I'm like, how do they know that? Did they really, you know? And so when I'm talking about fashion in the 80s, students are like, and I'm like, I lived it. I was there. So I know I'm getting older when I can say, I was there and I was dancing on the dance floor wearing those clothes. So I know I was part of that whole movement. So I can tell you what was really worn and what is more theory related. So, I mean, I think that's, and I folded so many sweaters that I can tell you what sweaters were really bought and what sweaters were not.
I do have to tell you, I'm in a bit of denial. I do not believe that the 80s or the 90s are historical time periods. I refuse to call them historical time periods.
Okay.
I know they're now studied within academic programs as historical time periods, but I'm in my world here.
I didn't really see my history unveil until I just saw Madonna's Celebration tour, and I saw her go through the history of her life, and I'm like, oh my gosh, I lived through that. And tonight, I'm going to see Taylor Dane, and knowing that Taylor Dane is celebrating her 62nd birthday yesterday, I'm like, okay, that's history. And I saw Taylor Dane in 1990 at the Park West in Chicago, and Kathy Dennis opened for her. And I'm like, I am dating myself like that. So it's so funny to me, but I'm like you, I kind of live in denial, but then again, I'm like, that is history. I hate, you know, and when you see your favorite songwriters or singers in media and you're like, wow, do I look like that? Do I get old too? Then you realize you are a part of history. So yeah.
Oh, okay. Well, Joe, thank you for grounding me and bringing me into reality. Fine. Yeah. We've talked about your writing and the importance of it. Tell us about your books. What brought those along and how did you go about writing them too?
So I'm really lucky. I was in 2007, right after I finished my dissertation, a man by the name of Joe Miranda, who is still at, came to visit us at Drexel. And he came with his display of books. I was his contact and he mailed them all. And then Fairchild used to come visit you and they'd pull up books on a table and everyone would come in and they would talk about it. And to this day, I always say Joe Miranda saved my life in a lot of ways. He said, Joe, we really need a book on branding. And I said, okay. And he's like, this is our idea. This is what we would do. And I said, I don't think students would read that. And there's something I have to tell, that to preface with. I am a child of Fairchild books. I had Fairchild books all through the 80s, all through the 90s. And so I have read so many Fairchild books. So I proposed, he said, do a proposal and we'll talk. And so I wrote this proposal and it was for this lovely thing. And I brought them with me today for this purpose. So I proposed this book, Brand Story, and they loved it. And I said, I would write this book like a gossip rag. I said, it's going to be case studies. It'll follow case study format, but students won't know that it's following case study format. It'll look like a People Mag. It'll read like People Magazine. And I have to tell you, this book opened so much for me. It came out in 2009. It didn't really do anything until 2011. And I also have to tell you this, it stereotyped me as, you're going to laugh, there came feedback from the world of academic scholars in textiles and clothing across the U.S. This book is too gay. And I loved it. And I'm not joking. And also, it came back as high-level journalism, which is what it was supposed to be. So I was like, yay, they got it. So anyway, long story short, I thought, one and done. It's written. It's finished. It's over. Hallelujah. It's going to go into book. And then along comes Amanda Brescia, who took Olga's place at Fairchild. And she came to visit us at Drexel. And she said, what happened with Brand Story? She goes, I have to tell you something, Joe. She goes, it's one of our top read books. And I go, so sellers? And she goes, no. She goes, when students actually have to get books, they actually read your book. And so she's, I'd like to do another one. So she said, can you give me a new one? You're going to laugh. Can you give me a new one in 6 months? And I said, okay. So that became this thing. And we changed the name of it to Brand Story, Cases and Explorations in Fashion Branding. And we changed some of the brands and we redid it. And so this came out in 2016. Yes. And so that was the, 2016. So that was the next one after the 2009. Then I said, okay, this is done. And if you go on to like Amazon, it's gone. You can't get it anymore. You can get the first one, but you can't get the book. So it's gone. So then a lovely woman by the name of Georgia Kennedy in the UK emailed me. And she asked me when the third edition of Brand Story was coming out. And I said, it's not. And that taught me that the UK folks and the American folks sometimes don't talk to each other, but that's because they're different divisions. And I said, there's not going to be one. And she said, oh no, I need it. And I never knew this, but Brand Story wasn't selling for her as a book for merchandising and fashion students. It was selling for her as students in fine arts who don't know how to brand, and professors were using it in their classes on how to teach art students how to brand by using fashion. So she asked me, would you like to do another edition? Mm-hmm. But I want to redo the whole, I want to rebrand Story. So in 2022, I did a new edition called fashion brand stories. So this is the latest edition. And so the name was changed and some of the brand and the brands were updated. We didn't replace brands. We updated brands. So there's a secret now I'm going to tell you. Number one, it has now been official. Oh, and then Georgia took this lovely thing. These lovely things. These were $90. So she took it down to $35. So it's $35. So now it's been selling. But here's the other thing. It is getting another edition. It's getting revamped, redone. It's going to be bigger. It's going to be a bigger book. Fashion Brand Stories is going into a fourth edition. So I have to tell you this story because number one, it's been rebranded. Brand Story was rebranded. And number two, your audience for who you think your readership is sometimes is not your readership. And number three, this is a project that I thought was going to go away after I did it once. And it's celebrating its 15th birthday and it's going to celebrate its 20th birthday. And so I'm very honored by that. But I just think it's funny that this is something I'm going to be known for that I never intended to be known for it, you know, as part of who I am. So I'm very happy about that. But that's the story of that book. And then other books, literally, Yolanda, I have been so lucky. So James Campbell, who was with Intellect, came to ITAA when I did the conference in 2010. I met him at PCA. We just became good friends. And I was on the bandwagon to do fashion stuff when Intellect was new. And I say this to everyone because when we see new publishers, sometimes the first idea in our minds is, oh, they don't have a reputation. They don't have a reputation unless you help them have a reputation. So I said to James, hey, listen, I'd like to do edited stuff for you in fashion. And he said, okay, great. What would you like to do? And I said, let's do one on fashion and popular culture. And then we did, and I did that with Vicky Karaminas and Tony Johnson Woods. And then when we first launched the journal, I said, let's do a special issue of the journal on fashion brands. And they said, okay. And so we did a call for papers. We got 30 papers and they were really good papers. And I said, can we do a book? And they said, sure. And so I got some colleagues together that also wanted to, for the first time, do a book. And so we did global fashion brands. And then I've just met people along the way. And I just decided, oh, let's do a book on this. Let's do a book on that. And I worked with James on it a lot. And so that's how my publishing has gone along. And then I, again, took a chance. These two ladies that I love dearly, Marilyn DeLong and Sandy Black. Marilyn is the most poker faced woman I've ever met. Never even know that she likes you, but she's so serious all the time. She was launching a new journal called Fashion Practice. And I said, hey, can I do a piece for you in that? And she said, submit it. And I did. And I was in the first issue of Fashion Practice. So it's just been this journey of taking chances. I have to tell everyone, I wanted to study fashion. There's not very many Americans that want to study fashion from an arts and humanities perspective. And I really wanted to do that. And I owe that to Gwen O'Neill, who said, stick with what you like. And then Trish did the same thing. These two women just really believed in me. And they said, stick with it. It will make you a success. Don't go to trend research. Don't do what everyone else is doing. Just stick with what you want to do and find the niche where you need to find the niche. So that's my story. That's how I've done what I've done. But the one thing I will say to you in my heart of hearts, this is where the journal comes in. I wasn't the only one doing this. I wasn't by myself. And I saw so many people when I was involved with the Pop Culture Association, I saw so many people that didn't have a place to put their scholarship. They would do these wonderful papers. One of your previous advisees is one of them, Dave LaRanger, who were doing, you know, really Jose Blanco. A lot of Black folks were doing things that were, you know, narratives and different types of pieces. And I said, there's got to be a place for them to publish. And so who did I go to? I went to Masood at the end. Masood was with James at the Intellect table. And I said, Masood, I want to start a journal. And it's like, about what's the market? What's this? What's that? Again, my retail background came kicking in and so did my work experience. And so I wrote a business proposal. Never knew this. When they start a journal, Intellect will invest about £100,000 in the project. It's expensive. So they put the money in. He said, okay, let's try it. And so we tried it. And I literally went to all those people that didn't have that place to publish. And so but I wanted to serve others. And so one of the things you and I've talked about before, I don't see myself as, oh, I'm a journal editor. I see myself as I'm a service provider for people who need a place to publish. And being a journal editor is not sexy. I am in sweats, wearing glasses. I have goggle glasses that I wear when I look at my computer normally. And I am sifting through papers, sending them out to other people to review. It's a task of love. And I'm not, I didn't buy a yacht on the royalties. That doesn't happen. That doesn't happen either. But it's a labor of love and I love it. But I wanted to help others. And I was trying to think, how can I help other people who are in a similar situation? And that's what I've done. And I have to say to you, the biggest thank you I've ever gotten is Dr. Jose Blanco wrote me this letter with all the horrible stuff that was going on in 2020 and the death of all the deaths and everything that happened. Jose wrote me this letter that I published in the journal that thanks me for always being a supporter. And I was like, wow. And I've always thought of myself as a supporter just because I'm gay, right? Mm-hmm. But he meant it as not all white gay people are supporters. Mm-hmm. And so mm-hmm. I really took that to heart.
Yeah.
So that's when I, for the first time, realized, okay, I did something good. That's when I finally said, I did something good. So yeah.
You have.
That's kind of my story. I've tried.
There's
more to do. There's more work to do. There's so much more work to do.
Yes, there's always so much work to do, but thank you for doing that work. And you've done more than try. You really have supported people intentionally too. And thank you. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure. But what I like about what's happening in our discipline is there are so many young people that are finally coming out. No, they're not GLPT, but they're coming out mm-hmm. in other ways. Mm-hmm. And they're coming out and they're saying, I'm not going to take this anymore. I'm going to look at things the way I want to look at things. Things are important. This is what's important to me as a young person.
Right.
And so it's just great for me to see that. And I think that's a wonderful future that we have. And it reflects what's going on in industry because we're seeing body inclusivity, body justice. We're seeing, celebrations of race. We're seeing celebrations of sexuality and gender. We're also seeing that those celebrations are still very important politically with what happened last year at Target and everyone boycotting Target because of the pride shops. So our industry and our academic endeavors are still very political. And I want young people to know that what they're studying is not frivolous. Fashion is not frivolous at all.
No, not at all. Oh, and as you're thinking about some of the things that you've mentioned here, you've talked about your network and really how the people that you have connected with. Could you talk a little bit more about that, especially for the students that listen to our podcast? Networking and connecting with people.
Yeah, that is probably key. I always say that having a network will allow you to grow as not only a professional, but as a scholar and as a mentor. And sometimes you'll be networking with people that you never even knew were going to be important to you for the rest of your life. You're an example of that to me. And then I have another colleague who is at City University of Hong Kong, Anne Pearson Smith, who's now at Nottingham University in the UK, and she's the department head there. She and I have done work together. We met at a conference. We had coffee and we became buddies. And she has my back. I have her back. We have appreciated each other so much. And I think the reason why I'm saying this is so important just with one person, because she has introduced me to other people. I have introduced her to other people. And it grows like a weed. It is like that. I can't remember the commercial in the 70s and 80s I think it was for a hair care. And a woman goes, I washed my hair with blah, blah, blah. And I told someone and they told someone and so on. And you watch the screen just get bigger and bigger with people. That's how the network grows. I always tell my colleagues at work, You want to know my network? Yes, it's right here in the back of this book. This is my network. Like, they're right here. And I literally also believe wholeheartedly. And when you establish a network, give to them something and they'll give to you something. And it's a give and take. And everyone takes care of everyone else. I will say for jobs, there's a secret here. I've never really applied for a job before. I have, but I did it through a network. When I got my first job at The Gap, it was because I was shopping there. And the manager said, do you want to work here? Then when I got my job at Limited, it was because I had a friend who had worked with a Gap who was working at Limited. Then when I worked at Target, it was because they were visiting the classroom and they saw me in action. Then when I got my job at Drexel, it's because my PhD advisor had a friend at Drexel, Miss Kathy Martin, who's been teaching here, who's getting ready to retire, I think. And she literally, they were friends from Costume Society. So everything was about networking for me. It wasn't about cold call. And so for a lot of young people today, I tell them that it's important to still network because that's probably how they're going to get their job. The other thing is we didn't talk about is I run the graduate program in merchandising and retail merchandising at Drexel. And it's a small program. It's a boutique program. I have been able to reassign, replace, or promote all the students that have been in the program but one.
Wow.
And it has all been strictly through network. The whole thing. It has not been through cold call. It's been because I knew somebody who knew somebody and they needed some. That's how it's all come about.
Yeah.
And so I think that's what's crucial. And it's not going to change. And I always tell students too, you can see someone on someone's LinkedIn. That's lovely. And yes, you can connect with them on the LinkedIn, but go meet them for coffee. Go talk to that person. One of my adjuncts, who's now one of my good friends, soon to be Dr. Kimberlyn Bethea. I don't know if you know this story, but Kim reached out. Kim graduated from Drexel Professional Studies years ago. And she reached out to me on LinkedIn and she said, I would love to meet you and have coffee. She and I met at Target in the food at Target and had coffee together. We didn't know each other from Adam. And we became friends from this meeting on LinkedIn and then this meeting at Target. And then we realized, we started talking, we're like, we're so much the same. Then we realized we're both the same sign. We're both Capricorns and our birthdays are like a week apart. But we think alike and we're very similar, but we have become good friends and she is an adjunct for me now and she has helped my students find jobs.
Mm-hmm.
And so this network continues to grow and it's amazing to me. Just one little gesture means so much to a person. And I always say but meet with people in person.
Yeah.
Because that in-person meeting can help you unless they're across it. But try to meet with them in person.
Yeah. Oh, thank you for that. Well, yeah. And along those same lines, you've talked about brand. And one thing that we help and support people with is developing their own personal brand. And since you're a brand expert, could you give us some advice for individuals that are trying to create their own brand? What are some things that they need to think about?
The first thing I say to them is, you need to understand how important it is for you to stay true to yourself. Mm-hmm. So when you create, there's materials, right? But the first thing is, how true do I want to be to myself? And I say this because there are still instances in finding positions and jobs for young people where somebody may tell you to take something off your resume. Mm-hmm. It still happens today. So your church is important to you and you're an active member of your church and you have done a lot for your church and you want to show service on your resume. Leave it there if it's important to you. If you are a member of a specific student club, if something is important to you as a person, leave it on your resume. If I am getting recruited for a position, it's blatant that I have supported student groups that are LGBTQ. I'm not taking that off my CV, right? So I tell people the first thing when you become a personal brand is to really look inside yourself and say, what do you want to represent? And don't sell yourself short. And the reason why I say this is because when you go out into the job market, you sell yourself short in that capacity, you will not be happy at your job. It will eat you alive. You will be like, why did I come to work here? And so I think, and I have advised students at Drexel that are in business, like we're talking finance, because I teach in the Honors College and I have all different types of students. And that's the one thing they always ask me, how should I present myself or brand myself? And I'm like, whatever is important to you, leave it on your resume, put it on your LinkedIn page, right? So it's very transparent. The other thing is always try to be, when you're doing your LinkedIn page or you're doing your social media, is realize that all of that is a reflection of you, and that will be examined by whoever is looking at you for jobs, right? So that's also important. I always tell students, I'm at a different standpoint than you. I'm at a different part of my life than you are. So some things, I'll put things on my LinkedIn that are like, you know, how to stay out of working in a toxic environment. I don't necessarily recommend that you do that, right? But because I am somebody who's to educate others on things, but you should only post the things that are very important to you, that you want a recruiter to look at and say, okay, this person is these things, okay? And that's what this person's about, right? And then the final thing is, it's an old-fashioned thing. Presentation of self. Like, really make sure you're presenting yourself that's true to yourself, but at the same time, know that the perceptions that others have of you is going to either A, help, or B, not help you. So it's okay. It's okay. So I'll talk to you. I'll use you as an example, Yolanda. You have that lovely natural hair, right? Yeah. And you're a Black woman. And so going into a job interview, are you going to decide, yes, I'm going to wear my hair natural? Am I going to be my natural self? Or am I going to go into this job interview and get my hair straightened? You know, and so that the traditional colonized look is there, where I'm less threatening because I have this straight hair, right? And so I tell all students these things because I want them to realize that even the slightest changes that they can make to themselves can really either A, make them really happy, or B, really sad. And so I just think it's important. And it's everything from things that we would perceive as conservative, right? So like, I have students that, like, I have a lot of young ladies, they're in sororities. They're the president of the sorority house. We would consider that the traditional, you know, maybe a conservative view. And I say that they're like, well, Joe, I'm going into this interview and I don't think these people like people that are in sororities. I'm like, then why are you interviewing there? If your sorority is important to you, that's okay. And if that is who you are, that's okay. Don't let somebody put you down. So don't interview there. Don't be a part of that. Don't be a part of that community. Go where you'll be a part of the community and you'll be welcome. So it's for everyone. It's a thing for everybody.
Thank you. Thank you for really emphasizing being true to yourself and being authentic. That's so important.
It's very important. So important. And I'm going to throw this at last minute. Students that are bilingual or international, say that you're bilingual on your resume. That's the number one thing they forget. I'll have a student that speaks fluent Spanish and I'm like, why isn't this on your resume? I just do it. And I'm like, no, you need, because the more global we become, the more global skills you need.
Absolutely. Yeah. So appreciate that. Yes. Well, it just changing topics a little bit and thinking about being true to yourself, though, still. Family. I know family is important to you, and that you've been a caregiver to your mother since 2004, but you've also maintained a really prolific career. And as a caregiver to my mother, we've talked about this. How has that impacted your life and career too?
So I didn't share this. I'm the only child of a single parent. My mom gave up a lot for me. My mom was a young parent when she had me. She was 21. And when she had her stroke the same year I came to Drexel, so I kind of did what I always call it, the Mary Tyler Moore. I packed myself up from Portland, Oregon, and her up from Minneapolis, Minnesota. How ironic is that? Because that's where Mary lived. And I moved us to Philadelphia. And I realized at that moment that I was responsible for another life. It had reversed. And so There have been sacrifices that I've made, not a lot. My mom's pretty easy, but I always like people I don't think realize that I actually do physical stuff. Like I actually bathe her on the weekends. I'm the person who makes sure her pills are all correct. I'm the one that will walk her when she needs to go out and Jill, who assists me with my mom, isn't here. Like I'll do those types of things. How it has restricted me is as a scholar, sometimes I can't go to conferences. I haven't gone to a conference probably that's not been on Zoom since COVID. When COVID hit too, I had to be more aware of her needs and my own needs. Like I was told, you know, you need to do this and this. And then the other thing is if I go to a conference, I have to have someone watch her, right? And so that's an expense. My husband can watch her and help me with her, but you know, he works as well. And then it's just been one of those things where I can't go to China and be a visiting scholar in China for 6 months. That's not something I can do. So I've had to really think about how I can be there for her and at the same time still maintain that edge of being someone who contributes to the discipline. But it can be done. It can be done. And I think that's what's important. And I always tell, because I get people all the time asking me this, do you feel like you're giving anything up? And I'm like, no, like, I don't really feel that way. I think my mom actually, I have to tell it the secret, it made me work harder because I was like, oh my gosh, I'm responsible for this life. This is the person that I have to take care of. So it made me more attuned to work and be that force for her and then the force for myself as well. And I will say, I feel like if I always say this is so sad, people talk about this, but it's true. If my mom was to like pass tomorrow, I feel like I did my job. And I say, again, I'm true to myself. And my mom did the same for her parents. And it's the kind of family I'm from. So I'm not from a family of extreme privilege or wealth. And so we have always been multi-generational in the home. So it's just something I was used to. Like when my mom had me, my father and my mother weren't married very long. They shouldn't have gotten married. And my grandparents stepped in and said, hey, we're going to take care of him while you get your master's degree. So it's just part of the family environment. So yeah, it's a good thing. And I think that you're doing the same thing for your mom. It's a good thing. And we're not alone. We're not alone.
No, yeah. There's a lot of people that are doing this and I don't think we talk about it much or share it much, but I'm so thankful that I have the privilege to share this time of my mom's life with her. Yeah.
I've learned all things about my mother that I never knew existed. That's been my favorite thing. There have been stories and I'm like, what? I know. She'll slip down. I'm like, what? I did what?
Okay. I agree.
So yeah, that's I tell people don't give up that time with you.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's absolutely precious. It's really precious.
It is. And I'm lucky even though my mom raised me most, my father was a lot younger than my mother I didn't know that either. But my father and my mother were both very accepting of me. I think I always tell my friends, be accepting of your kids no matter what, because they're going to decide what happens to you later. And then also they exposed me to so many different people. I think that's where even though I'm gay, I have gay friends that aren't open-minded. I think that people think, oh, a gay person, you're supposed to be open-minded. And I'm like, no, I have gay friends scare me that are Republicans, and I'm not getting political at all, but they're somewhat conservative. And I'm like, wow. So I think my parents just having all different sorts of friends and all different sorts of people around them really helped me a lot as a young kid growing up. I think that's what it was. That's what did it. And I thank both of them for that. And I thank my mom for that. So, I mean, that's why I take care of her, because she's never, nothing phases my mother, nothing. So, yeah. Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Oh, well, I'm so glad that you get to spend this time with her, too. You know, as you were talking about stories, too, from your mother, thinking about just storytelling and technology, What are some trends that you see happening that can help people tell stories better? Are there technologies? We're in such a technology world right now.
All right. And what's funny is I use storytelling as my basis of my research, but I believe the basic frame of story is classic and won't go away. But I do believe that, that Instagram, you know, all the social media that is out there is a great way to tell your story. And I think that there's two types of social media, and we didn't talk about this, but I think that there's professional social media and then there's social media. And so I think that being versed in both of those is crucial. I think that if you want to get out there and tell your story, the one place I'm not going, and I tell myself I'm not going there, is TikTok, but they're all on the TikTok, you know, they're all TikToking. So it's like, I will go, I'm enough now. I'm like, okay, Instagram, Facebook, I'm on Twitter, but it's not really my thing. And a lot of people have left Twitter because of what, you know, the buyout and the changeover. And so that's been a, you know, for a lot of people. And then LinkedIn for me, I think LinkedIn for me is my big one, right? And I also think that with social media and the storytelling ability, I think that as time goes on, well, there'll be something next, right? And so I think that each form of social media kind of dates you. Like our generation is Facebook. It's where the face, like my friends still put stuff on Facebook. That's like who it is. But the other thing I think is important is what you're doing is I think that you're somewhat telling your story, Yolanda, by doing this with different types of people. You're literally telling a story in and of itself of how important differences are to you. And you're also talking about, you know, you're immortalizing people. I've always said this, the best book that hasn't been done is the contributors of our scholarship. And this is something you're doing that, right? And so I think that is a great way to tell a story about a discipline, to tell a story about people. And I think that someday, I hope 20 years from now, someone is still able to watch this and say, wow, there's that Joe Hancock. That's what he looks like. And there's Yolanda again. You know, I think that's what's important. But I think that doing it smart, like one thing that I'm really bad about and I've got to start doing, I'm creating a website this summer. I've never had a website. I don't know if websites are dead, but I'm going to create a website because my colleagues are like, you need a website with all your stuff on it. And so I'm going to start doing that, but I haven't done it. I need to work. And I also want to say this, and it's something I have to start doing. I have to have a social media day now where I just put up social media because I do social media for the journal as well. And I just, if I don't do it, I don't do it.
Yeah, it's a lot. It takes a lot of time to do all of that and to tell the story.
It does.
Oh my goodness. So if people would like to get a hold of you, would LinkedIn be the best way or?
LinkedIn, I'm on Facebook. So my LinkedIn is just Joseph Henry Cock II. They can put that in Drexel University. It'll pop up. My Instagram is Cargo Joe. My Twitter is Branding Joe. And then my Facebook is my name as well. And also you can do for Facebook and all of these, you can also do fashion, style, popular culture, and the journal will come up on all of these platforms as well. Yeah, you can reach out to me. You can email me. You Google Drexel University and Joe Hancock. I pop up. Don't laugh. If you Google cargo pants and Joe Hancock, that'll pop up as well. I'll pop up then. So yeah, we never talked about the cargo debate that happened, but like that was a big, I don't know if you, do you remember this? In 2016, in the Wall Street Journal, there was an article on cargo pants done by a woman by the name of Emily Hong. Emily Hong was a reporter that reached out to me and she did a big story and I was in it. Changed my life forever. But yes. So if you Google cargo pants and Joe, I come popping up.
Which is great. Which is great.
Yeah. Anybody can reach out to me anytime they want.
And we'll make sure that your contact information is with the podcast and then also on our website too.
Yeah. Yes. And I'll send you a picture tonight. I actually did the VIP with Taylor Dane. So I'm going to get my picture taken with Taylor Dane. I'll send it to you.
Oh,
for you, for this.
Oh, wonderful. Yes. Please.
There's Go ahead.
Oh, I just said, please sing and dance for me while you're there.
I will. Well, what's funny is what people, so I'm going to leave you with secrets about me. My secrets are that I'm a huge Taylor Dane fan. I'm a huge, I love Madonna. I'm not as a big fan as my husband. And I also, so behind me, you can see a little bit, I also collect Catwoman memorabilia. So I have been collecting Catwoman stuff since I was a child. So there's only a few action figures behind me, but in my basement, there's so much Catwoman stuff. You would die. And I read the comic. And so that's a little bit about me that you guys don't know.
I did not know that. Oh, that's cool. That's very cool. Oh, well, my last question is, how do you define innovation?
Innovation to me is actually thinking outside the box. And it's not necessarily technology related. It's a way that you express yourself in a different way or in a new way that's new to you and others, or it's a new way of thinking or a new way of presenting outside of the box. And I always say that because we think of innovation as something related to a tech. And I always say it's not. It can be anything so long as it's thinking outside the box and maybe putting things together that haven't normally been put together. And that's actually what I represent. So I think that's what's innovative. And it's really learning as the receiver of that, it's learning to think about those ideas being presented to you and accepting them and saying, hey, this person has a different view than I do. And that's okay. And give them a chance to explain it and also give yourself a chance to absorb it before you judge it.
Oh my goodness. Thank you. Thank you. And that ending part was very important. Yeah.
Yes.
Taking that time to understand and not judge.
I always say one of my students, I learned this, a student of mine said, her mother has said to her since she was a child, you don't have to accept, but you need to respect. And I thought that was the best quote ever. And her mother said, you're never going to accept everything, but you should respect it. And she said, and that's it. Oh. And I'm like, you know what? That defines a lot for me. And it was an undergraduate student.
That's another gem. You have given us so many gems in this conversation. So
I hope so.
You have. So as our conversation with Dr. Joe Hancock II ends, I just want to thank him for his invaluable insights and stories with us today, Joe's journey through fashion branding, retail, and academia, and his profound commitment to diversity, equity, and inclusion has enlightened us and inspired us to view fashion and storytelling through a more thoughtful and inclusive lens. So thank you.
It was my honor. Thank you.
To our listeners, thank you for tuning in to today's episode of the Innovation Insights podcast. Dr. Hancock's work underscores the significant impact that thoughtful branding and storytelling can have on our understanding of fashion, culture, and society. Whether you're a student, a professional in the fashion industry, or simply someone fascinated by the power of stories, there is no doubt that today's discussion has provided much rich food for thought. For those interested in delving deeper into Dr. Hancock's work, I encourage you to explore his books and research, which offer a treasure trove of knowledge on fashion branding and serve as a testament to the transformative power of inclusive storytelling in the industry. Remember to watch future episodes where we'll explore the innovative minds that are shaping our world. If you enjoyed today's episode, please consider subscribing to our podcast, sharing it with friends, and leaving us a review. So once again, thank you, Dr. Hancock, for joining us and sharing your profound insights. I'm Dr. Yolanda Sanders, and I'm signing off until next time. Keep innovating, keep dreaming, and keep making a difference.